Moncrief on News Talk.
While Iran is ruled by an oppressive theocratic regime, that doesn't necessarily tell you what the country is like for the people who live there. Tomas McIntyre, who spends much of his time cycling around the globe, travelled across it last year. Tomas, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. How are you? Thanks a million for having me on.
Could you tell us first, how do you get into Iran? Like, do you have to jump through a lot of hoops to get a visa and that kind of thing?
No, it's not too complicated at all, to be honest. You can go two ways about it. You can apply for a visa directly through a government website, but they do have a high rejection rate. So it's easier just to go through a tour company. You pay them an extra 25 euros or dollars or whatever, and you fill in a couple of forms, and then they do the rest for you. And then you get a code, and you have already pre-arranged a embassy or consulate in a country near enough to Iran, and you go there and you just pick up your visa, no questions asked normally.
Okay. And when you had to fill out a form, what kind of things did they want to know?
Just the usual, your name, where you're from, your kind of a loose itinerary of where you'll be and what you'll be doing. Now, because I was on a bicycle, of course, I didn't say that I was traveling to the country on a bicycle. I've done this with a few countries just because it's just much easier, and they don't ask how you get there, they don't ask what you're going to be doing there, you just say nothing, and the less you say the better. But I just put down a few dates of like cities and like hotels I found online that I would say that I was staying at, but I wasn't. There was no issue.
Right. Okay. So, and you went over the border. As I understand it, you went over the border from Afghanistan. So, I'm sure there's a story there as well. When you go over the border, though, into Iran, did you know where you're going to be staying, or were you thinking you might just pitch a tent someplace, kind of thing?
Yeah. So most places I've been around the world, most days I don't know where I'm going to end up that night, unless I've something prearranged. But when I crossed the border into Iran, I hadn't a clue. I just said I'd get to the first town, stock up on some food, and then just tear off and see what would happen. And on the way to town, a car stopped and he got chatting, and he was a lovely fella, and he was asking where I was going and what I was doing and stuff. And I was just like, oh, I'm just going to go into town. And because it was winter time, it was quite cold at night and the weather was a bit unpredictable. So I'd often try to find somewhere warm to stay, like indoors. Like you could go to like a cafe, a restaurant. Usually mosques were a great spot to ask and stay in as well. So I told him I was just going to go to a mosque and ask if I could just sleep inside for the night and be gone early in the morning. So he drives off anyways. And next thing, he 20 minutes later, he pulls back up again and he offers for me to come and stay at his place. Huh. So he tells me just cycle to town and I'll be waiting for you. And just like that, I got to the outskirts of town and there he was. He was pulled up on the side of the road waiting for me. And I followed him through town to his house, got to stay with him for the night. And after being in Afghanistan for nearly a month traveling through, no word of a lie, this fella's house was like staying in 5-star accommodation. You know, there was a fridge, there was a washing machine, flat screen television, there was heating, hot shower, hot water. He took me to his wife's family's house, to his mate's house, and each house I went to, they just put colossal amounts of food in front of you, endless amounts of tea, chats, photographs, you name it. And that was the first evening.
Yeah.
And I was like, Christ, if it's like this every day, like, A, I'm going to put on huge amounts of weight, and B, I probably won't get to cycle anywhere because people are going to keep stopping me and inviting me places, and they don't really take no for an answer. It's almost like an insult if you say, oh, look, sorry, like I have to ride 150K today. You know, it just baffles their mind. They're just like, no, like you're coming back to my house and that's it. Like, we're going to take care of you. You're going to meet everybody. All my family are excited to meet you now. And it's a huge thing for them to do, to invite a foreign guest into their house.
Yeah. Now, did many people speak English, or how were you communicating with each other?
Do you know what? A good few could speak it, definitely. Iranian people are highly educated, highly intelligent. And if they didn't speak it, you know, you have access to the internet. So I downloaded Farsi on Google Translate offline, so I could always communicate. And they'd also use Translate as well. So it was easy to communicate with people. And even if, you know, you're in a place with no internet, like Afghanistan, for example, the internet there is terrible. You know, sign language would always work as well. You know, telling someone that you're hungry or you're thirsty or you need a place to sleep, it's universal, and, you know, that they understand it perfectly. So there was never any issue. There was one time I was out in the desert cycling between the cities of Isfahan and Yazd. They would have been in the news recently for being bombed by Israel, but beautiful historic cities. And two cars stopped me, and a bunch of guys jumped out, and I realized fairly quickly who they were. They were, you know, police and army. And they jumped out, and they didn't speak any English. They just like asked me for my passport. You know, they were tapping their hand, like, and I knew straight away that they were what they were looking for. And I just started like listing off the names of villages I was passing through, just to give them the impression that I knew where I was going and what I was doing and stuff. And when you're on a bicycle, you know, a lot of people, they don't see you as some sort of a threat.
Yeah.
You know, I think most occasions people take pity on you because you've got all your bags, you know, all my sleeping equipment, my cooking gear, my spare clothes, my electronics. The bike weighs about 40 kilograms, so it's quite heavy. So they don't see you as a threat. So they took my passport. They obviously would have taken photographs of it, sent it off to whoever. And then when I told them where I was heading to, what I was planning on doing, they just said, okay, they just waved me off and they offered me water and stuff and made sure that I had like food and water before leaving me. And so even when they don't have English and you're in the desert with no internet, there's always ways to communicate with them.
Yeah. Now, obviously, I imagine most of the places you went through, you were, apart from, I assume, Tehran or something, but you would have been a real, you would have stood out, like there's a white guy cycling through the town kind of thing. So would people, and this kind of overwhelming hospitality, was it to a degree, do you think, like, we're going to make a point here if Westerners turn up, that we're going to show we're not, you know, kind of lunatics, that we're actually normal human beings?
In some countries maybe, but Iran, a lot, you'd be surprised, like Iran has a big tourist scene, and a lot of people do travel through Iran, because especially if you're overlanding, whether you're traveling around the Middle East or the world on a bicycle or in a 4x4, Iran is your gateway into Central Asia. You know, you leave Turkey, you either go through the Gulf, which is more awkward because you have to start getting ferries and flights and things like that, or else you go through Iran. So they're well used to tourists being in the country. But I think just they're genuinely just kind-hearted people. And I find this in pretty much all the Muslim Islamic countries I've been through, because in the Quran, it's said that you have to look after your guest. You have to look after your guest. You have to do what you can do for them, make them feel comfortable. You know, I tell people I was camping, whether I was in Iran or Sudan, Egypt, Afghanistan, you know, Malaysia, even recently in like Saudi Arabia, Oman, I was in Syria, Lebanon. If I told people I was camping, they'd almost be outraged that I'd even consider camping, because they were just like, no, like you're a guest. We're not leaving you sleep in your tent. You're coming back to someone's house and that's it. Like, we're going to, you know, you're here. We're going to take care of you. We're going to feed you. We're going to give you water. We're going to give you colossal amounts of tea. And we're going to make sure you have a packed lunch leaving tomorrow. And we're going to make sure that, you know, if you're going to a town that we have friends or family or connections, we're going to make sure that when you get to that town, that they're going to look after you. And it's an incredible domino effect across the whole country. But no, I mean, like I said, you know, and for like countries like we'll say like Iran, again, Afghanistan, where it's so difficult for them to leave. It's so difficult for them to get visas to come to Europe, to travel in Europe. So as another way as well, you're basically their source of information for outside of Iran. You know, they're always asking questions about like Ireland, about Europe, about what, you know, they'd ask me where I'd been before Iran, and I'd list off a heap of countries, and they'd be like, oh, like, please tell us more about like Vietnam, or what's Timor-Leste, or what's Indonesia like? So, you know, you're having a great chat to them about the rest of the world as well. And yeah, they just want to showcase that, you know, everything that's said about them, whether it's from Western governments or media or Western people in general, that it's not true about them, whatever about the government in charge of them. But regarding the people themselves, I can say from being there myself and a lot of other travelers who've been there, that, you know, the people of these countries of Iran are not a representation of their government. Absolutely not, for sure.
Yeah. And did you get a sense that they're kind of aware of that, that they're aware of what, you know, might be reported around the world about Iran, and when was there, you know, did they have to be a bit circumspect about what they might say about their own government or their attitude towards it?
So yes, they're definitely aware of what's said about them. So two things. So number one, they would literally beg me to make sure that I told everyone I could about my time in Iran, and to pass on from them personally that, like, they're not dangerous people. They're not these so-called jihadis who are running around shouting Allah Akbar, just randomly blowing themselves up or whatever. That they're kind-hearted people, that they're loving people, and that if, you know, more guests come to their country, that to tell them and reassure them that they'll be taken care of. When you're there and when you hear them say this, like, you know, you can hear and feel the desperation in their voice that they just want to be understood, that they just want to be seen as human and not these dangerous people.
Mm. Yeah. Now, I assume the kind of the conditions you were in when you were in Afghanistan, probably traveling from Afghanistan to Iran, even though Iran's suffering all sorts of blockades, that Afghanistan was immeasurably worse there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I've been to two countries in the world that, you know, you're just kind of scratching your head being like, what the hell is going to be the future for these places? And that's Afghanistan and recently in Syria. More so Syria, just because of the scale of destruction. But in Afghanistan, I mean, look, everyone knows the Taliban are back in power again after 20 years of US occupation and NATO. And, you know, traveling across the country, you just see incredible poverty and hopelessness. And, you know, sometimes you leave some of these countries feeling somewhat optimistic that, okay, you know, maybe in a few years' time, things will get better. But Afghanistan, I've no idea. I've no idea how things can get better or if things will get better in time. All I can hope is that just some sort of peace stays in the country. That, you know, it's not just back to endless wars again. And that, the you know, because the people, one thing that they'd always say to you is that, you know, they're not happy with how the situation obviously is in the country. But they're just like, look, at least we've peace and we can be more optimistic that our kids aren't going to just get killed and stuff like that. That somehow that by the time that their time comes, that when they leave, that somehow in some sort of a way, you know, the future might be better for their kids and their kids' kids. And sorry, just going back to, you know, people talking about the governments and things like that. Surprisingly, people are very open, especially in Iran, criticizing the government or regime or whatever you want to call them in charge. Perhaps less so in Afghanistan, just because I'd only gone to Afghanistan, what, like 2 years after the Taliban retook control. So people are obviously still scared of speaking out. But in Iran, they're a lot more vocal. You don't even have to ask. They will just go off into a tirade about the situation in the country and how unhappy they are and how they want things to change. Syria is another incredible example of that. Now that Assad and his regime are gone, you know, people for what, 15 years couldn't speak about the government there, because if they did, you know, by God, the next day someone would be knocking on your, well, not knocking, but someone would be barging in your front door and taking you away, and that's the last your family would ever see of you. But now that Assad is gone, like, I remember my first evening in Syria after I crossed the border. I didn't even know if I'd get across the border or if they let me into the country, but they did. But my first evening, I stayed with a local man who saw me cycling past where he was living. And he called me over, and he spoke English. So he called me over and I spent a lovely evening with him and his family. They drove me around the place. They showed me around. But he had fought for the rebels against Assad and his forces. And, you know, straight away, he was just straight in criticizing them, calling them monsters and all sorts and telling me all the horrific things that happened. You know, he showed me around the back of where his old house used to be. And this was a very common trend in Syria, where I'd stay with the local family and they'd be living in a completely new house to what they'd been living in before, because their previous house had been bombed, completely destroyed. You know, the Syrian army just came in with the planes, and just any town or city or village or region or suburb that went against the government was literally just bombed into end of existence type stuff. You know, I mean, the amount of villages or towns I was in where 60, 70, 80% of the area was just completely destroyed. People had fled, but now people are moving back. They're moving back into houses that just you wouldn't put a dog living in, but it's their home.
Yeah.
You know, God, like just listen to them speak about it. And they're just like, I remember talking to one guy, I was up in Malula, which is the one of three places in Syria where like they still speak a language very, very similar to what Jesus spoke. But I met these local guys and they were just like, go 5K down the road and you'll see another small town completely destroyed. So I went there and packed up the bicycle, went walking around as you do. And a local guy saw me and didn't speak a word of English. He just grabbed my hand and I followed him, of course. And he took me all around this town and down into alleyways. And I couldn't understand a word he said. So eventually I got Google Translate out. And as he was speaking, I had to translate up to his like mouth so that it would translate for me. And some of the things he was saying, like he was listing off all these different families, all these different friends, like these people were killed. These are my friends. They're all dead. These ones are gone. These ones I'll never see again. But I remember one line he said, and he was just like, we fled once before. If they come back for us, we're not going to flee again. If we have to sit here and eat the dirt, that's what we're going to do. Next time if they want to kill us, they're going to kill us on our own land, on our own ground. And when you hear people say that, you know, you're just like, these people just are so brave and courageous, but they just want to live in peace.
Yeah.
And it just has a profound effect on you.
I imagine it does. How long have you been doing this for, Tomas? Cycling around the world, I mean.
On and off. Like, it's not continuous. My first trip was in 2016 across America. And since then, I've been just going off and on whenever I can, or whenever I have like enough money saved or whatever. So I'm actually nearly finished like the wider world cycle. I'm in Spain now. And in a few days, I'll take the ferry to Rosslare and cycle back home to Kerry. But I know deep down that won't be the end of it. Like, it's just, you know, I feel, even though I'll have cycled the world, I just feel as if I'm getting started, that there's still more for me to do out there and more to see and stuff, you know? So I think it's just going to be like a never ending journey and stuff. So, because the world's ever changing, you know? I mean, like, I started 8.5 years ago and, you know, I could go back to America now, and even America could be profoundly different to, I could have very different experiences to what I had 8.5 years ago. So,
yeah. Now, on that subject, I assume that if you go into Iran or Afghanistan, they don't stamp your passport. Though the American form, if you're looking for a visa, they'd ask, have you been there?
Not with Afghanistan, would you believe? Oh. They don't. Yeah. If you go to Afghanistan, you'll have no problem. Well, before Trump came back into power, you'd have no problem getting back into America. I do have a Afghan visa in my passport, and I do have an Iranian stamp, of course, is an issue, as would be the Syrian stamp. So, you know, I'd have to, if I did want to go back to the States, I'd have to go for an interview, probably, you know, up in the embassy in Dublin or whatever, and just explain to them what I was doing and see what outcome they come to. But no, Afghanistan prior to Trump taking power, there was nobody had any has, because it's a question. I'm still in the WhatsApp group chats for like some of these countries, and one that's always asked, and a question that's always asked in the Afghan group chat is, oh, like, has anyone had issues getting into other countries, like especially America? And the answer 100% of the time was always no. Like, I've never been quizzed or asked anywhere I've been about countries. I even like having been to Syria, Lebanon recently, and Afghanistan, Iran last year and stuff. But obviously with America now, especially since Trump came back into power, there'd probably be issues if I did want to go back to the States.
And when you're in Afghanistan, the likes of Afghanistan and Iran, the bicycle, I mean, you're putting in a lot of mileage on the bike, and, you know, things go wrong with the bike. How do you kind of factor that in?
You'll always carry spare parts. You'd always have like spare tubes, a spare tire just in case, you'd have a spare chain, stuff like that. I usually like I'm good for keeping the bike up to scratch, because you never know when things go wrong.
Mm.
But there's mechanics and stuff as well. Like, I mean, in Kabul, I had to get a couple of bits done, and it's gas when you go looking for stuff, because like there wasn't a bicycle shop per se there. But you start walking down the streets, or you start like asking people, you point to the bicycle and you kind of make the motion with your hands that like something's broken, and they swing into action. And I remember like I did this in Kabul because I couldn't find a bike store. So I was like, right, I have to go ask people. So the first person I asked, he again took me by my hand, told me to follow him. We went down some side streets, and voila, we came to maybe his friend, I'm not too sure. And this guy was able to do what I needed. And then in Iran, like another good example, my chain snapped and I didn't have a spare link. And I was going up into Tehran. So I was coming from the Caspian Sea. So you have to go up and over these high mountains. Beautiful. And in the height of winter, you know, there's snow all around you. You wouldn't think it like when you think of Iran or the Middle East, but like you can go skiing in Iran. But anyways, I had to start hitching. And a car stopped, and he said that he'd seen me earlier in the day, and he had U-turned, because he said he'd seen me earlier in the day, and then he saw me again, and he saw me hitching, so he said he'd U-turn, and he wasn't going anywhere near Tehran, and Tehran at this stage was a good 100 kilometers away, and he wasn't going anywhere near. He was actually on his way home, and he saw me, so he was going to the coast, so he saw me, and he swung around, and I told him, I was like, oh, my chain's after breaking, you know, the link's gone. And to be honest, I was on a bit of a dangerous road with a lot of dark tunnels, so I wasn't too disappointed. I picked a bad road to go up. So without any hesitation, he grabbed the bike, opened up his boot, and he was just like, jump in. And, I was just like, no, like, you're not going to Tehran. Like, I was just like, it's okay, someone will be going. He's like, no. He was just like, and he's, in fairness, like, he spoke good English as well, and he was just like, basically like, if you think for one second I'm going to leave you here on the side of a road on the mountain when it's cold, you know. He was just like, absolutely not. So he drove me whatever couple of hours to Tehran. We stopped, we had coffee, we had ice cream and stuff like that. There was like places on the way he wanted me to see. Huh. We got up to Mount Damavad, which is the highest mountain in Tehran, and our outside and the highest mountain in Iran, sorry. And we were there taking photographs. He dropped me into the city, dropped me at the door of the hostel I was staying at to make sure I got there safe, like helped me take the bike out, gave me his phone number.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Tomas. I've gone way over time interviewing you as it is. That pretty much sums up around that last story. Thank you so much for speaking with us today, and best of luck on the rest of your journey home. That was Tomas McIntyre there talking to us from Spain, but as you heard, been many other places as well.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 p.m. on News Talk.